Hello, and welcome to 37th and the World, the official podcast of the Georgetown Journal of International Affairs. The GIA is a student-run, flagship publication of Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. On 37th and the World, we dive into key global trends and speak directly with the experts working on these issues in areas ranging from conflict and security, human rights and development, science and technology, society and culture, business and economics, and global governance.
Relations between China and Western nations have been strained for centuries, and both sides have sought out various models of economic interdependence. As China reaches a new challenging stage in its economic development, Dr. Alicia Garcia Herrero, Chief Economist for Asia Pacific at the French investment bank Natixis, discusses the motives behind China's economic policy.
First of all, I'm an economist, as I said very clearly, although I'm very interested in geoeconomics. I see everything from the light of economics. So what I'm going to try to say here is that I actually think the economic situation in China determines a lot of the political decisions. For many, it's the other way around. Political decisions kind of lead the way to China's economic situation. I actually tend to believe that the Communist Party's model to stay in power was an economic model. I give you growth, I give you well-being, I give you the rapid increase in purchasing power, and as a Faustian kind of deal, you give me a number of things, yeah, including your hard work, parts of your freedom, but not all, and so on and so forth. So I do think the economic situation in China, in a way, is one of the most important ways in which the Communist Party finds legitimacy. It's one of the very key points, probably also, to be frank, beyond economics, also territorial integrity. And this is why, you know, we've seen many of the things we've seen. So these two, to me, are key. I'm not going to talk about territorial integrity, but I'm going to talk about the economic situation in China. So I'm not going to go all the way into history, but since President Xi came to power, because this is really the topic of the conference, I think President Xi knew that he was in a roller coaster that was actually already going down, in that, you know, that he was coming to power at the peak of China's economic growth, and that's exactly 2012. And I'm sure many of his advisors told him it can only go down, but we can at least smooth out that downward path. They probably told him that that had nothing to do with him, but rather than this is the law of gravity, as I mentioned in the meeting, meaning that as you get close to $10,000 per capita, that's what happens to economies. The question is how much you can actually cushion that deceleration. And this is really also Scott Rosell's book on rural China. I mean, the idea being, will China be able, now that its income per capita is 10,000, indeed, i.e. a middle income, to get to the high income champion group, because there are very few out there that have managed in the last, say, 5 decades, very, very few countries, many of which actually, interestingly, are European, but this is because of basically the European Union project, meaning a lot of help, yeah, from others. But who can do that for a country of the size of China? I mean, it's very difficult. So I think knowing all of that, President Xi has designed an economic agenda that is central also to everything else he's doing, including foreign policy, which is the topic of your conference. To start, he needs to make sure that on the dual circulation side, that the first area of circulation, meaning the domestic market, remains the market of Chinese companies. You see, basically you cannot share that market because that's the source of your wealth, in as far as many of these companies basically have quite a lot of margin, profit margin, because they work in an oligopolistic environment. And with that profit margin, they go to the rest of the world and expand. And this is why today we have already more Chinese companies in the Fortune 500 than US companies, for example. It's unbelievable, but it is true. Why? Because they make full use of that market. This also means that China has not opened up fully to foreign direct investment. So there's many sectors that are still closed to foreign competition. This also means that increasingly China is focusing on self-reliance, meaning on producing everything China needs. Why? Because they want to extract all of the rents from their own market. This is the first idea. Because these rents are going to, in a way, to cushion the deceleration. Okay, this is the second, and this is your question on the Belt and Road Initiative, is that you need to profit from external markets as long as you can. And this means, first, try to make some markets captive. By captive, what I mean is that you become the largest exporter. Maybe you also import key commodities from them. Think about Africa, Latin America, some Southeast Asian economies, so that they cannot say no to you, because if not, you stop the imports. This has happened to Australia, for example. Yeah. So basically, you become dependent on China. And I think that is China's game in the Belt and Road Initiative. Create the infrastructure, indeed, for these countries to look towards China, meaning, thanks to that infrastructure, the easiest economic linkage becomes China. And you can think of Pakistan. Pakistan wasn't linked to China, yeah? But the thing is, now it is. Why? Because of massive infrastructure investment. This is like more than $40 billion already. But that makes Pakistan, in a way, more dependent. I mean, also, of course, it's a source of income, no doubt about it. But the point is, now Pakistan is more integrated to China than it is to the rest of the world. And this is thanks to massive infrastructure investment. So this is now captive markets. Interestingly, with COVID, even the West has become slightly captive, because given the fact that it couldn't produce its own goods because of the lockdowns, China has acted as quote unquote exporter of last resort to even the US and Europe. This is why still today, the fastest growth in exports in China, which is massive, China's trade surplus, we had numbers this weekend, has continued to balloon, but mainly thanks to the US and Europe. Why? Because our ability to produce is still rather limited, even in the post-COVID world, because labor market constraints, etc. So China is playing that double game, meaning the rents from its own market, all for China, quote unquote, and then captive markets in the rest of the world. Why? To cushion what is undoubtedly a structural deceleration, which is not, I don't want to blame China on that one, because that happens to every single country. We have a report coming out. There's a nice graph there, potentially even useful maybe for the article, but of course it's really, I don't know how you're going to write this, but I can always send it to you. This is really a comparison with every country that has exited the middle income trap, starting with Korea. I mean, like kind of where they were when they were $10,000 per capita, and what was the average growth rate in the next 10 years. So China today, I mean, how much should China grow to still be stellar? So the largest growth rate, the highest, is South Korea, 5.5. So if China grows more than 5.5 in the next 10 years, China will be stellar, if you see what I mean, like absolutely great, because it doesn't need to grow 8 or anything like that, because it will be one of the fastest growing countries after reaching $10,000 per capita. Then below South Korea, you have Japan in the 80s and blah, 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 all the way to countries that only grew 1%. So where will China be? That's the key question. And in my view, China, unfortunately, is heading towards the low end of the table. Maybe not 1%, maybe 3%. Why? Because China is closing down. Yeah, I mean, people-to-people movement, very restricted. Even the Belt and Road Initiative, China is facing humongous pressure now because it doesn't have the ability, in a way, to control all of those projects as people cannot travel anymore. You know, it's very, very costly for them, this zero COVID strategy, in terms of what they are trying to do. So I think once, because they're aging even faster, COVID is not certainly not helping towards aging more slowly because people are scared. You know, it, actually the population fell last year in China and it will continue to fall because these subsidies that they're giving are not enough and people just feel their future is very uncertain. And with the, again, with the zero COVID policy, even more. So I think China will see a very rapid deceleration in the next years to come, which will be a huge challenge for you know, frankly speaking, for the party, because that might not, how would I say, China might not make it to the high income group. And might indeed still fall into the middle income trap. Although President Xi Jinping has said loud and clear that China has already surpassed the middle income trap, this is not accurate, at least not in economic terms, because that's only when you move from 10,000 to say 20,000. China is not yet there. It's doing great to reach that goal because it's grown very fast. But the question is, what now? What now? And I think self-reliance, closing yourself to the world, aging even more rapidly, frankly, is not going to help. So I'm not very optimistic on this objective. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was honestly really great. And it actually answered a lot of the questions that I was going to ask you. So thank you so much for that. I think one of the questions that I had was a little bit about U.S.-China policy, because I've read a bit of your work. Yes. And I've noticed how you've talked about how both the Biden and the Trump administration frame China as a strategic competitor.
Yeah.
Do you see any, how does China's shift towards self-reliance, as well as the U.S.'s actions that further isolate China, affect the idea of global cooperation on global issues, for example, climate change and global disease prevention, yeah, especially in light of the climate change conference recently and the COVID pandemic?
Okay, so I think a number of things. The party, or at least President Xi to me, and this, of course, not that I know him or I have any right to judge what he thinks, but, you know, just my humble interpretation of what I read. He believes, and frankly, he's not the only one, that the West is in demise, you know, that the West is in decline, that the U.S. Will no longer be the hegemon, and that its time is over. And there's been a lot of events lately, to my dismay, that could, in a way, hint to that, you know, to that reality. So I understand where he's coming from. I understand that even China's historically strong civilization, you name it, he can feel that he needs to take that role. I mean, whatever. But from that standpoint, I think the time goes, I mean, on the one hand, time goes in his favor because the U.S., you know, Biden has a very elderly president, to be frank. We had, you know, a lot of issues, yeah, from the Capitol to Afghanistan. I mean, I don't think he feels fully threatened, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it's like a shield. He wants to shield the Chinese economy from sanctions, from things that can hurt China although ultimately not change the course of history. I think that's kind of the way I read his interesting, by the way, speeches. It's very, very interesting to see what is, he has like a mandate of heaven, you see, you from the way he writes. And I think a person like this can be very daring, very bold, because he has that mandate of heaven. He believes that everything he sees are just temporary constraints, but ultimately not. So he can play hardball, if you see what I mean. And I think this is exactly what's happening in US-China relations. I think that President Xi wants to leverage from everything he has in the light of a weak US. And he even has, which is ironic to be frank, something like being the largest emitter in the world. Because it's an asset, if you think about it. It's a liability, of course, in my view, but it's an asset if you can leverage on it. Everybody wants it. Everybody wants China to reduce emissions. So this is the price. He's leveraging. It's a leveraged cooperation, meaning it's not a free or voluntary cooperation. So the world has learned this, and I think the world is struggling its head. What I'm going to do with a China that doesn't want to cooperate voluntarily, but that wants to use, in my opinion, the climate agenda also for some additional purpose. It could be the US totally lifting import tariffs from China. It could be, you name it. Yeah, I mean, the US being less belligerent. And I'm sure you've seen this from Wang Yi's speeches, that it's all or nothing, basically. Don't come to me with climate. Come to me with the whole agenda. So China is playing this game. I think it's actually, again, counterproductive, because the whole world has by now understood it, you know. In other words, I think in something as sensitive as climate, where everybody's by now, you know, very aware, China can only get more enemies, if you ask me very frankly, in terms of public opinion, by playing hardball with something that everybody cherishes. It's like if you do this with terrorism, or if you do this, you know what I mean? Like, it's just such a bad thing in the eyes of everybody that I think it doesn't pay off to play leverage with something as global, human, as climate. I think they should do that with other stuff, but not something that everybody watches, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. But again, they're doing it because they are underestimating the still power of, in a way, of democracies, or, you know, public opinion. They're underestimating it because they didn't need to worry about it for a long time in their own countries. So they just can't believe that, you know, that governments may be pushed. This is true in Germany. 76% of the population are asking the new government to be very tough on Germany, on China, which is unbelievable, because Germany has been a winner out of, you know, out of this economic relation. Why? Because people, if you ask people what they care about, they may care more about climate than about exports. And I think China doesn't get that, you know. So anyway, this is my point on US-China relations. I think, in a way, China is underestimating a concerted move by the West, or even beyond the West, Japan included, only because it believes that its leverage is humongous. It's infinite, given the size of its market. But, you know, Australia shows that Australia is cut off, yeah, from China, whether it's coal, whether, but Australia's economy has done well. So there's a little bit of a counterfactual to the reality that without China, you cannot even breathe. And I think China is now kind of realizing that as their economy slows down, again, counter to the idea that they have all of the time they want in this great power competition, they don't. Because the Chinese economy soon might grow less than the US. And that will be a shock for anybody who thought, okay, this is our future and there's nothing but China in the world. Yeah.
Gotcha. So just as kind of a follow-up to that, once you do kind of, it seems to me that you do predict a bit of China's economy slowing down, contrary to popular belief, especially with its government. Do you see, whether or not that happens, do you see any potential for global economic reconciliation in the near or far future between China and the West? And why or why
not? Thanks. Just to warn you, I know it's a bit embarrassing, but I only have 3% battery because I wasn't expecting to rush out of home because of no Wi-Fi. So, I mean, it's already a miracle we're doing this interview. So anyway, long story short, I think, so your question really is there the space for reconciliation? Mm-hmm. Yes, there will be. But I think the order of, in time-wise, I think this will happen when China comes. I mean, you know, like every country, including mine, which I'm from Spain, I still remember the boom years, you know.
Mm-hmm.
People were crazy, including the government. They wanted to get into the G7. I mean, like, how can you get into the G7? You know what I mean? People get crazy when they grow. We need to realize that we're all hubris and egos. I mean, especially politicians. So, China will understand the need for reconciliation after a little bit of a crash, if you see what I mean? Because then they will be more kind of more adamant, more accepting of a more multipolar world. China today is a winner takes all. Winner takes all strategy. And I think they might move away from that once they see that that strategy doesn't actually lead you to winner takes all, you know, like generally soft power is stronger than hard power. And since you study when you are, you know, an international relations student, which I've never been, but I've learned over time. So I just think it will take time. China first will need to go through a little bit of a hassle, I have to say, which might last all the way to 10 years. China will then be a much more stable economy with a more of a middle income class and so on. And I think it will approach the world in a more open way. So this is one of the very many, for anybody who studied China, cycles of opening and closing. It's not new for China. It's just one more cycle that we're entering. And I'm afraid we're entering the closing cycle. And we need to go through that. And then when China reopens, it will be in a more reconciliatory mode than it is today. And the West will want China because the West is not going to grow any faster without China. You see what I mean? So everybody will be more open to reconciliation than, but give it at least 6 to 8 more years at least to get there. Not now. I don't think it's possible now.
This was 37th and the World. Thank you to Professor Alcide Garcia Herrero and our interviewer, Giovanni Tawari. Please be sure to subscribe and leave a comment and rating, whichever streaming platform you use. To read this interview and other insightful interviews and articles, please check out jagia.georgetown.edu. Thank you for listening. See you next time.